It is Friday, November the 30th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you here. Coming up, U.S.-China trade tensions at the G20 summit.
President Trump is really unpredictable when it comes to China, and his advisors are really split down the middle on how to proceed on the issue of China and tariffs.
Rebalancing China's economy.
If you look at the discussions of growth and development, you don't see balance or rebalancing or imbalances as an objective.
Also ahead, building boats can change lives, plus some sounds from the world of music. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Leaders of the world's top 20 developed and emerging economies are in Buenos Aires, Argentina, for this year's 19th G20 summit. It's today and tomorrow. They represent 85% of the world's gross domestic product and three-quarters of its population. Once designed specifically for finance ministers and central bank governors, it has now evolved since the 2008 financial downturn as a leaders' summit. Before leaving for Argentina, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned that the world faces what he called a crisis of confidence and outlined to reporters what he believes are the pressing issues that require what he called strong leadership and bold action.
These meetings come at a crucial moment. Our world is obviously facing a crisis of confidence. Those left behind by globalization are losing trust in government and institutions. Inequality is pervasive and increasing, especially within nations. Trade disputes are escalating, and an undercurrent of geopolitical tensions is adding further pressure to the global economy. It is imperative that we address the root causes and work together to promote a fair globalization.
And also, trade tensions are to be a major concern. International Monetary Fund Managing Director Christine Lagarde said The vehicle tariffs, for instance, alone could cost the global economy nearly 1% growth. And ahead of the summit, China's President Xi Jinping pledged greater access to China's markets and strengthened protections for intellectual property. Cecile Shea, a non-resident fellow in global security and diplomacy at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, tells VOA's Victor Beatty the really important discussions will be the ones on the sidelines, especially the heavily anticipated encounter between Presidents Trump and Xi.
President Trump is really unpredictable when it comes to China, and his advisors are really split down the middle on how to proceed on the issue of China and tariffs. And so anyone would be foolish to try to predict what's going to come out of the meeting between the president and Xi. Certainly, people who have in the past predicted, oh, don't worry, it will all work out. The president will step back from the brink on major increases on the tariffs. They've been wrong every single time. So I think if you had to place a bet right now, you'd have to bet that the United States is going to go ahead and impose yet more tariffs on China and raise the existing tariffs up to 25%. And this is just going to be very bad for the U.S. economy. We've already seen how it's been harming our major automakers and now the auto workers who are going to be laid off from GM, for instance. It's been a disaster for soybean farmers here in the Midwest. And it's going to be very, very hard on consumers if prices for all sorts of items begin to rise precipitously. But it looks like we're probably not going to see a lot of progress. But, I mean, who knows? The president likes to surprise people.
The Kremlin said Russian President Putin and President Trump would look for ways to break out of a deadlock in the relations when they meet. Given what's happened with regard to Ukraine and the Crimea, Mr. Trump put in doubt whether this meeting would take place. Do you anticipate that it will take place as the Kremlin seems to be?
The Russians are saying the meeting is still on the schedule. We haven't heard a lot out of the American side. I think it's a good sign, actually, that the president has come out and said that he's very angry about the attack on the Ukrainian vessels. So I think that the U.S. needs to take a much stronger position with the Russians. And what would be best? I mean, in the best of all possible worlds, there would be a quick sidebar with, you know, German Chancellor Merkel and with the President of France and with certainly the Prime Minister of Japan, other like-minded countries, and everyone would decide that they were all going to say the same thing to Vladimir Putin about the Ukraine. in the best of all possible worlds, that's what would happen.
Two other world leaders are going to be there, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, and Turkey's President Erdogan. That might be an interesting meeting.
Yeah, I mean, that's really what the press is really watching, how the other 19 leaders react to and deal with the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. You know, there's even calls inside Argentina to charge the Crown Prince with a crime. So it's going to be very interesting to see two things. One is how the other leaders approach the Crown Prince, because clearly the glamour and the good feelings toward him have worn away. And secondly, how this G20 visit affects his own standing back in Saudi Arabia, where there are concerns among his cousins and siblings about whether he is the guy to be leading this country into the future.
Cecile Shea of the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, she was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. Still ahead on International Edition, balancing China's economy. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Mammals are a class of animals that are best known for their ability to nourish their young with milk produced by the mammary glands of females. Now a team of Chinese researchers say they have found that the young offspring of one jumping spider species is completely reliant on the nutritive spider milk discharged and fed to them by their mothers. Writing in a study published by the journal Science, the researchers also say they found that the jumping spider mothers continue to care for and nurse her young spiderlings into young adulthood, even after they have already learned to find food and feed themselves. The study suggests that the spider's milk has four times the protein of cow's milk. Scientists have previously found that other non-mammalian species, such as the pigeon and flamingo, are also known to nurse their young with mother's milk. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Before we get to China's economy, we have this story that senior UN advisor and the special envoy for Syria, Jan Egelin, is accusing the international community of cruelly disregarding the suffering of the Syrian people and failing, he says, to protect them in the name of waging a war against terror. Lisa Schlein reporting from the UN in Geneva.
Jan Egeland has led the UN's humanitarian effort in war-torn Syria for many years. As he steps down from his post as senior advisor, he delivers a particularly blunt assessment of the international community's role in abetting the worst instincts of all the warring parties, to the detriment of the civilian population.
We allowed all hell to be let loose in the most populated civilian places of a heavily populated country.
While most of the country has been forcibly pacified, Egeland warns the humanitarian situation throughout Syria remains critical. He says he is particularly worried by a recent escalation of violence in the northern cities of Aleppo and Idlib. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
China's economic growth is expected to hit 6.6% this year and slow to 6.3% sometime in 2019 as that country struggles with challenges relating to trade, as we've said already in this program, and structural reform. Meantime, a number of observers believe China needs to rebalance its economy, but one economist disagrees. I spoke with Yukon Huang, a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and former World Bank director for China. He explains why he believes China has plenty of time to think about rebalancing.
If you look at the theories and discussions of growth and development, you don't see balance or rebalancing or imbalances as an objective. Growth is always increasing your capacity to produce, how fast you grow, how much you invest. The focus on imbalances came up because China, by global standards, has an exceptionally low ratio of consumption to investment, an exceptionally high ratio of ratio of consumption to GDP, an exceptionally high ratio of investment to GDP.
And actually, don't some see that as a risk?
No one sees these ratios as an objective. The objective is to grow, to develop, to have higher living standards. And it turns out that successful countries go through phases. When they're growing very, very rapidly, in fact, the growth process is very unbalanced. When they start to reach develop income status, higher income levels, their growth naturally becomes more balanced. And you see that in developed countries.
I believe that you're warning that prompting balance too early might actually do the reverse of what some might expect. It could cause stagnation of the economy?
Yes. If you look at the relatively few countries that have managed to go from what I would call upper middle income levels to advanced economy status over the last 30, 40 years, you'll find that only a handful of developing countries have managed to do so. Most of these have been in East Asia. There's the South Korea, the economy of Taiwan, Japan, Singapore. And when you look at the critical phase, when they were having income levels of between, let's say, $10,000 to $15,000 per capita, their growth was very unbalanced. And when by the time they reached the higher income standards, then they became more balanced. So many people have argued to China, you want to get to high income level, you should become more balanced, when in fact the opposite is true.
And why is that?
Well, the reason is that growth and productivity is essentially dependent upon investment. You don't grow by consuming. You grow by investing. You grow by increasing productivity. And you grow by getting higher technologies. And that all comes through the investment process. It doesn't come through the consumption process.
You know, we think of China as a country where they spend all the public money on the public sector. What about investment in the private sector in China? Is that on the upswing, or should it be?
Well, when people look at this issue of the role of the private sector, you come out with quite different views. Some would say that the state sector remains very strong, very dominant. If you look at it over a couple decades, in fact, the opposite impression comes through, and that is the private sector's role in the economy has consistently been getting bigger. They account for 89% of the employment levels. They probably now account for 80% of production. They account for probably 70% of investment. And even during the last 4 or 5 years, when a lot of investment was going through the state, it is still the case that investment from the private sector is greater.
The world had gotten fairly used to China having large economic growth, and it's been lower in recent times. And more and more I'm beginning to see people write things like this, that 7% is the new norm, and China should be happy with that. What do you have to say to those thoughts?
Well, we only have what I call comparative experiences. Here we're trying to look at the comparative experiences of countries which have done reasonably well. And those countries which have done reasonably well have managed to grow at rates like 9, 8, 9, 10% for several decades. And that's the China case. And China is essentially moving to the 7, 8% range.
And what about down the road, your thoughts on the prognosis for the Chinese economy?
They're in a very difficult situation. They had this massive stimulus in 2008 and 2009. $600 billion pushed out into the economy over 2 to 3 years. Now, for a while, people were actually thinking this was well done or a good thing. If you go back to 2010, China grew at 10% a year in the midst of the global financial crisis. So everyone was applauding this. But the reality was it was excessive. It shouldn't have been going up to 10%. It should have been actually moderating, going down to 8 or 9. So they have a problem. They overstimulated. And now they have to live with the consequences. And the consequences is that the debt levels really soared.
Yukon Wong is a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where he focuses on China's economic development and its impact on Asia and the global economy. Well, the art of building small wooden boats is being used to help young at-risk adults turn their lives around. At a seaport center in Alexandria, Virginia, not far from Washington, they are serving as apprentices in a boat-building program that gives them the skills, the confidence, and the discipline to change their lives for the better. We get more now from VOA's Deborah Block.
Apprentice Chris Atkins is learning what it takes to build a small wooden boat.
It's been fun to learn how to use these tools.
Here at the Seaport Center on the banks of the Potomac River in Alexandria, Virginia, the small group of apprentices from 18 to 22 years old learn how to build sailboats and canoes.
Learned definitely, measured twice and cut once.
Besides carpentry and mathematical skills, the 19-year-old from Florida is also learning more about himself.
This opportunity really has given me the opportunity to really dig deeper into myself and find what I want to do.
At the helm of the program is Jimmy Gottfried, who had also been an apprentice.
Many of the apprentices in our program have faced many challenges in their life, such as lack of family support, dropping out of school, having run-ins with the law, and they're looking for a way to gain back the confidence they need to go back out into the workforce.
So that you can.
The year-long program pays a small stipend. The apprentices are guided by volunteer mentors, like Fred Geiger, who teach them how to build the boats and improve their lives.
When you work with wood, you feel it, it becomes part of you. And as their self-confidence gets better, then you can start to address some other things in their lives, like are you paying your bills, where you living.
Atkins had to drop out of high school to work.
My mom died when I was 8 years old, so that's always something that's on me. And if I haven't had the support from my father, the one reason that I came to the program was because they want to help you. And I guess what is hard for me is because I'm not used to someone wanting to help me or enthusiastic about it, or if anything would believe in me.
We'll find out. You'll get
apprentice program manager Jay Helinski is a role model for the group. He completed the program about a year ago.
And they know that I'm, you know, living proof of what hard work, dedication, and just the willpower to succeed gets you to.
When the boats are finished, they are sold at a raffle. Atkins says he will be sad to see them go, but knows, like life, they are meant to sail onward.
It's all the creativity that goes into making them. I'm glad that they're going out and they're going to a good home.
Deborah Block, VOA News, Alexandria, Virginia.
And still ahead on International Edition, the sounds of Janelle Monáe. This is VOA.
Hello, peepstas. Welcome to the weekend. I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Boy, do I have a show for you. 55 minutes of cool, commercial-free, Pan-African music. Hear your favorite current Afro beats. Discover new music from Ghana and meet Blinky Bill from Nairobi. He's just released a new album.
Even if you know a lot of things, there's no guarantee that you're going to see it tomorrow.
Revel in earthy African classics from Mali, Cape Verde, DRC, and South Africa. All this and more this Sunday at 15:05 and 20:05 UTC. Just tune in to your local FM station and meet me there. Music Time in Africa.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Now it's time for a little something from the world of music. Janelle Monáe is an American singer, songwriter, actress, and model. During her career, Monáe has received 6 Grammy Award nominations, a MTV Video Music Award, and the ASCAP Vanguard Award. She also was honored with the Rising Star Award in 2015 and with the Trailblazer of the Year in 2018 at the Billboard Women in Music.
I'm
was a big hit for Janelle Monáe, who was born in 1985 in Kansas City, Kansas, and was raised in a working-class community. As a child, she dreamed of being a singer and a performer and cited the fictional character of Dorothy from the film The Wizard of Oz as a musical influence. Monáe moved to New York City to study drama at the American Musical and Dramatic Academy and attending a performing arts camp called Freedom Theater, the oldest African-American theater in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And coming out of all of this is a big fan favorite, her song Prime Time, performed with American singer-songwriter Miguel. President Obama and his wife Michelle invited Janelle Monáe to perform her hit song, Tightrope, at the White House.
Y'all ready to have a good time? All right. This song that I'm about to sing was on the First Lady's Let's Move playlist, and it was inspired by the words of our president, you can't get too high, you can't get too low. This song is called Tightrope. Hit it, man!
During an interview with the London Evening Standard, Janelle Monáe said that she only dates androids. That's a reference to her musical alter ego found in many of her songs. She added that she would talk about her sexual orientation in her words in due time. And in 2013, Monáe stated she wants both men and women to be attracted to her and that she identifies with both bisexuality and pansexuality. And is a self-appointed spokesperson for the LGBTQ community.
Yeah, I'm talking about you. You get a ride or you get leave. Cause baby, whether I'm high or low.
You gotta check out Janelle Monáe on YouTube. Nobody moves around the stage any more than this gal does. She's amazing, amazing. Hey, listen, many thanks for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you here. The latest world news is up next, so we hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Carl Starling, I'm Steve Norman. We're all in Washington, hoping you have a super Friday. Now a bit more from Janelle Monáe.
I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on The Voice of America.
Earth and Sky.
This is Joel Block. Recent thinking suggests that Saturn's rings are billions of years old and that Saturn recycles its rings and even creates new ones. Here's Earth and Sky's Jorge Salazar with more.
Thanks, Joel. In the 1970s, Voyager 1 provided the first close-up views of Saturn's rings. Astronomers determined then that the rings were a temporary feature, formed about 100 million years ago when a moon of Saturn was struck by an asteroid. But evidence from the more recent Cassini mission suggests the rings are much older, as old as the solar system itself. I spoke with Larry Esposito, principal investigator of the ultraviolet imaging spectrograph on the Cassini mission to Saturn.
Well, now on Cassini, with even closer views, we see even more rapid processes inconsistent with a single moment when all the rings were created. So there's a process of continuing creation going on in the rings. When the rings were made by shattering of a small moon, the pieces can come back together and the ring can make a moon again. And this recycling very efficiently uses the ring material so that they can last for the age of the solar system.
Esposito said that even as we look out at Saturn today, new rings are being formed.
And in fact, there's structure in the rings that we see today that was not seen 25 years ago by Voyager. So there are small rings that have been created in 25 years.
Larry Esposito speaking with Jorge Salazar. We're Earth and Sky, a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
This is VOA.